As most of you know, Swami Kriyananda, the founder of Ananda, arrived a couple of days ago for what will be 4 months in America. He came on Thursday, arrived safely after a not too difficult flight. His health is not as good as we would like it to be, so his spirit is without boundary, but his body's a little tired. So he, as you all know, he's obviously not here. He was never scheduled to be here. But he sends his blessings to all of you. He's just resting. He'll go back to Ananda Village tomorrow. And in 2 weeks, he'll do his first public program in America at Ananda Village. But he did want to send his greetings and his blessings to all of you and his deep joy at being in America and looking forward to this summer of being able to see so many devotees here. He really divides his time now on three continents. He's in when he's not in America, he's in India or Europe, and they're rejoicing in his company. And so he's become, he's always been a world traveler, but now he has to be shared among many. I remember in the very early days of Ananda, it must have been 1971 or 72, and Swamiji was reading from, we were actually cleaning out his library. The scene took place, I remember sitting on the floor, and he was sitting on the floor, and we were going through some books, and he started reading from some prophecy that was offered by the Book of Bhrigu, which was some extraordinary book that was created by the great sage Bhrigu thousands of years ago, and yet is still accurate. And in it, it made a statement about the time when Swamiji would be a world figure. At that time, we were a struggling group of about 50 people living on kale and Jerusalem artichokes up in the hills of Nevada County, just barely making it on a day-to-day basis, and spoke of Swami being a world figure. And there was another devotee in the room, and in a very kind of almost like a teenage groupie way, "Wow, that'll be neat," she said something like that. And Swami very sweetly said, "These are the good old days." And he sort of sighed about the burden of fame and responsibility. And what we see now in Swamiji's life, which is just very interesting, was he had a tremendous amount of work to do. He had to write a great many books. He had to lay the seeds for Master's work. Master came as the incarnation and put the ideas out into the ether. And it really was Swamiji's responsibility. Looking back now, you see it. He celebrates 60 years of discipleship this year to create what we really call the culture of self-realization, writing out all those ideas into books, creating communities and living examples, planting the seed of discipleship in now thousands of people around the world. And all that work couldn't have been done with the kinds of draw on his energy from people that there is now. So in a certain sense, and this is not uncommon, a kind of almost a veil of invisibility was over his aura until recently, because now essentially all the work is done. He often says now that the Bible commentary and the Gita commentary have been written. It's just all been done. He refers only to finishing the last half of Promise of Immortality, which is supposed to be 52 weeks of Bible commentaries, and there's only 26. He says he wants to get it finished, but he doesn't want to do it right now. But beyond that, he has the satisfaction of looking back and saying, "Everything that I determined as a young man that I would do for my guru and that I felt he wanted me to do, I have done." It's quite a remarkable thing to say. So he watches his body not function all that well, but there's an extremely strong split between consciousness and physicality. And those of us, and it's not all of you, but many of you have been in contact with Swami one way or another for a long time. Last Sunday, I meant to mention it just out of sentimentality, but I forgot. It was the anniversary of the day I moved from San Francisco to the Ananda Ashram in 1971, June 1st, 1971, so it was 37 years. Last Sunday, it just kept slipping out of my mind. Swamiji told us it would be auspicious to arrive on a Tuesday before noon. That's the Indian tradition. So I drove in at 11:30 on that Tuesday from San Francisco. So one reflects a lot, and hearing the commentary today which talks about how Judas, one of the chosen 12 apostles of Jesus Christ, yet managed, instead of being, you know, celebrated in all of history like Peter or Paul are celebrated for serving their guru in this great way, actually set, it's the definition of traitorous behavior. His very name has become a description of the last thing that anybody wants to be identified as. Someone to be called a Judas, you know, that's a terrible thing to be called, isn't it? And yet, and the masters want us to really understand this, he was born and recognized by his master as a great soul. And merely because he not only slipped a little, but he actually fell, it didn't in any way change, in a certain sense, what he had attained. And because he had attained so much, he was able to recover from it. He repented immediately of what he had done, which is why as soon as Jesus died on the cross, almost just right after, Judas committed suicide. He hung himself. And that was an obvious gesture of realization that some great sacrifice was needed because he'd made such a terrible error. The way Yogananda explains Judas's intention there, and it's implied by this Bible reading, is that Judas became infatuated, in this case with money. He had a certain attachment to money, is how he's often described. And because of that, he began to think about other qualities. It's such an interesting thing. You see, one small delusion leads to another. You have this one small thought, and you have that desire for that one thing, and then you move out into that reality, and then that brings other realities. And that's why it's often so dangerous. I remember a man many years ago had a strong desire. That was like in the early 70s again. He wanted to go to India. And Swamiji suggested to him that it would be better for him to get deeper on the path before he went to India. He said he felt that his time in India would just scatter his forces until he was deeper and was able to benefit from what he would experience. And the man did not want to hear that advice. I mean, it's so common, isn't it? We go ask someone for their advice, and actually all we really want is their approval. And so it's a little delicate sometimes. And the man said, well, but I'm so restless. I have such an intense desire to do this. I'll never be at peace until I fulfill this desire. Sometimes Swamiji handles everyone differently. He answers people according to what he feels will be helpful to them. And he said very strongly, you have millions of desires in you. If you think to get out of them by fulfilling them, you will start now and it will literally never end. Just like that. And the man did not follow his advice. And eventually, actually, because of his desires, he didn't betray, like Judas did, but he betrayed his own higher calling. One thing led to another. Pretty soon, he's just living a very ordinary life and can only vaguely remember what all that spirituality was about. Just becomes self-justifying. This is where I am. Also, the vibration of spirituality is very subtle. And when you move out of it, sometimes you don't even remember that it's there anymore. So this extraordinary example of Judas, who wanted Jesus to be more conscious of what he was doing in terms of this world, that was the essential fight, Yogananda said, that Judas had with Jesus. That Jesus was not paying enough attention to the power structure of this world. He was associating with low people. He was even allowing this low consciousness woman, this low class woman, as it were, to anoint his feet, which in itself was just way over the top as far as Judas was concerned. He wanted a little more decorum, a little more thinking of marketing principles, of who was in power, of all those things. And his actual intention, which really makes his betrayal even more tragic, was he thought he would force Jesus' hand. He would pit him against the power structure, and he thought that Jesus then would reveal the power that he had within him. Because Judas made this mistake to think that worldly power and divine power are the same thing. But Jesus instead accepted that, and the way Swami described it recently, speaking in Rome, sometimes, in fact, Swami posited that this is a law. He said, in order for the divine to grow, the worldly must be reduced to absolute zero. That all aspects of the ego have to be obliterated, because only in that soil can the divine power grow. Now understand, aspects of ego are not creativity, determination, divine ambition, intense energy, and willingness to work on spirituality or on serving or even just working for your careers or your creative art. It's not intensity or magnitude of effort that makes people egoless. Somebody was talking about a certain person and saying, oh, he has no ego. And I said, it's not that he has no ego. He has no charisma. There's a great deal of difference. To have no magnetism is not necessarily to be egoless. In fact, sometimes people with no magnetism have even greater ego because they're so self-concerned that their constant, the constant vibration of their energy is around the thought of self. I mean, and individuals like Master had no ego, of course, at all, except he was overwhelmingly powerful. So much so, I mean, he could command a room of thousands of people. There's a magnificent story told about Master when he was giving a lecture. This was said at a very large hall with some thousands of people there when he was lecturing in his early years. And there was somebody in the front row, a couple of people in the front row who somehow decided, this is not for me. And they got up to walk out because they didn't want to be there. He ordered them from the front. Sit down, he said. Sit down. You can't leave now. You're never going to hear another lecture like this. Sit down. And he just made them sit down again. You know, I mean, what are you supposed to do in a picture like that, right? I mean, this is not what we think of gentle Jesus, meek and mild. You know, the stories of the life of Christ, too, are filled despite, I mean, Judas's gamble that Jesus would stand up to the authorities was not entirely based on nothing, because there are so many stories in the Bible where Jesus defiantly spoke to the priests who had all this power over him, or where he rescued the woman who was going to be stoned for having been caught in an adulterous liaison. You know, that people came with rocks in their hand, and the woman found Jesus and threw herself at his feet. And they're all standing there. Imagine the fury of this. People holding stones in their hands, ready to stone this woman to death. And Jesus rescues her by saying, whoever among you is without sin, let him cast the first stone. And then the legend, whether it's true or not, is that Jesus started writing in the sand with a stick. And the way they interpret that is every person who was there saw in their own mind all of their own transgressions, and one by one, shamefacedly, they dropped their stones and went away. And then, of course, he turned to the woman and he said, sin no more. You know, because it wasn't as if she was innocent, but the fury and the wrath that they were bringing to bear on her. So Judas had reason to believe that Jesus would, in fact, focus that power in the way that Judas thought he ought to, and then there would be this glorious coming in of the kingdom of heaven, and Jesus would reign as a king forever and ever. And I'm sure Judas saw himself at Jesus' side, you know. But none of it came out that way. Because over and over again, the ego intrudes itself. And the ego is very simply our sense of self identified with the wrong things. You know, identified with ideas and fulfillments and experiences that we are so persuaded are the keys to our happiness, that just as the Gita describes, we contemplate them. And then as we contemplate them, they get more and more attractive in our minds, and we desire them. And then once we desire them, all this impatience to have it happen, we become infatuated. Infatuation being the delusion that this and this alone can make me happy. And then when it doesn't turn out that way, we become resentful, we become angry. And once we're angry, we can't tell what's true anymore. And once we can't tell what's true, we don't know where to go on the spiritual path. And so we find ourselves, and it made so much sense at the time. And then off we are, and then another incarnation is passed. Here we are, just having spent one more, and then death comes, and we say, what a chump I was. I had so many chances to just follow the true path, and then I lost it again. Being in Swami Kriyananda's company, and sort of like we're all in his company, I want you to understand his physical body is, of course, limited now, and it just can't be everywhere like it used to be. But the life of Christ continues to inspire. The presence of Christ continues to inspire. None of us have met Paramhansa Yogananda, But we read Autobiography of a Yogi, we hear his voice on a tape, we see his picture, and something happens. Someone was telling me recently why they came to Ananda for the first time. I was asking in a class, and the person was saying that they'd seen Yogananda's picture, it may have been on the outside of our program guide, many, many, many times. And then one day, the eyes just spoke. And essentially, the eyes said something like, "Where are you?" A friend of mine told me his story about how he came to be a disciple of Master. He was somehow or another, the whole story was so complicated, but this is how it ended up. He was in some area, I think New York City, or some major urban area. There was some kind of a bookstore. For some reason, the bookstore had a very large poster of Yogananda in the window, or maybe a picture of the AY. The bookstore was almost entirely shuttered, except for just the part where Yogananda's eyes were looking out the window. The man was in a very, not very uplifted state of consciousness and was standing on the corner, and he turned around and these eyes are peering out the window. You know, on one hand, it's remarkable, isn't it? But there's another aspect to that which is so profound, which is what how Swamiji puts it. He said, we think of infinity, and we always think of infinity, or we think of omnipresence. We naturally think of it as being huge, don't we? Because our concept of reality is huge. From Swami to get from Rome, from Assisi, where he was living, took him, he had to fly to Rome, he had to fly to London, he had to fly 12 hours across the ocean, he had to cross the United States, hours and hours, this huge distance. We see St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome, and they're trying to express to you just how big God is, and the cathedral's so huge, you know, just everything is big. But it also implies, omnipresence implies, that God is everywhere, in every little tiny thing. And also that reality is telling us that no one thing is more of God than anything else. One of the teachings that Master has in his affirmations for healing is he talks about every little cell in your body, every atom, is endowed with individuality. Amazing. I was reading, I'm so non-scientific that this may not be stunning to all of you, but I finally understood a small aspect of physics where they talked about atoms do not make predictable decisions. That was how it was finally communicated, so I understood it. That they can anticipate only to a certain extent, and then the atom seems to make up its own mind about what it's going to do. And they, you know, they're trying to work with that. I hope I haven't garbled that hopelessly, but that's what I read. And it's so perfectly in keeping with Master's teaching that even on the level of the atom, it's dowered with individuality, and it has its own response. Gee, I think I'll just go this way. You know, and the scientists have the whole experiment, and it's all supposed to go this way, but it doesn't feel like going that way. It goes this way, you know? That's what our individuality is. Our consciousness is feeling. Consciousness is just not entirely reasonable. It's moved by other realities. And Master talks about how every cell in your body is intelligent. And one of the ways you activate healing energy is you appeal to the individual intelligence of each of those cells. And one of his beautiful affirmations refers to all the cells imbibing divine light, and it refers to their tiny mouths, the tiny mouths of all those cells. One of my friends who had a cancerous tumor, she just loved that one. She was always thinking of the tiny mouths of those little cells. It's just so fantastic. What was I going to say? Just a moment. One of the exercises that Swami gives us, the superconscious living exercises, is you rub your body all over and you say, "Awake, rejoice, my body cells." Like that. "Awake, rejoice, my body cells." We do meditation one classes. People come in from who knows where. You know, they have terrible jobs and they're so stressed. One woman, I said, "Why are you here?" "I have three teenagers." Everybody said, "Say no more. You know, we all understand why you're here." You know, she just looked like this. She said, "They sent me here. Mom needs something," like that. And there's a certain amount, of course, people who work in this particular area, which is not exactly known for its childlike attitude toward life. you know, people are serious and they're often, they come in black and they're just all sitting there like that. And we get them to stand up and say, awake, rejoice, my body cells. And you can just see people that going, awake, rejoice, my body cells. You know, it's like, this is just, this is ridiculous. But it isn't, you know? It's just like, there's so many avenues in to essentially snipping off all those little threads of ego. And part of it is really just recognizing that this is not what it seems. That the childlikeness of that whole set of exercises, I'm awake and ready, you know, and we go, I'm positive, energetic, enthusiastic. It's all part of the same set of exercises. But what we're trying to do is to say, this whole construct that we protect so carefully, and we have to always have it look just so, and this world we live in is this particular culture, this particular time, it pushes us in that direction. It pushes us toward a very gross consciousness. The music, the fashions, the infatuation with money and power, all of it, it pushes. And the world has always pushed. I mean, Jesus didn't exactly have it easy. I mean, his life didn't end in a really great manner. I mean, it ended perfectly in a divine way, but the culture was not supportive, let's just put it that way. They put him to death. That's about as unsupportive as you can get, I think. And we're all working with this, but you see in the Bhagavad Gita, which is also ancient, it just says, you have to be very, very careful. Because the mind can so easily just be drawn off into something that seems so innocent at the beginning. But then little by little, we find our focus has shifted. Now what we have to balance that, and of course, the dice are actually loaded in favor of divine realization. Because every atom is divinely created, and every cell is dowered with, has its own intelligence. Every part of us, there's no aspect of any aspect of consciousness. It's all consciousness. It's all divine. And I was saying before, every part of it is equally dear to God. Just as we sit here, we are just little radiant beams of light who are absolutely unified with the infinite light. And that infinite light is pure consciousness, and that pure consciousness is bliss. And these masters who come, and the great saints who are in tune with them, and I certainly count Swamiji among those souls who's living even now and happens to be visiting our particular part of the world. But it doesn't really matter where they are. It matters where we are. I know one of the monks and one of Master's disciples in SRF, somebody came to him and he said, well, I don't really think I can follow Yogananda because I need a living guru. And he said very seriously, the monk answered back, he said, oh, Yogananda is living. It's you who are dead. Just like, you know, the consciousness, the vibration is always there. The masters are they never go anywhere. Swamiji once was repeating the story which he tells in The Path about how Master revealed the fact that he was always conscious of every, well, he showed himself conscious of things that Swamiji had done at a great distance. And just commented on them as if it had happened right in front of him. And Master Swamiji was so shocked, he said, sir, you know. Like, how did you know that I spoke that way? Master just looked at him like this, I know every single thought that you think. And when Swami said, told us that story once, I said, is that still true? And Swami just looked at me like this, and he said, of course. Now, Swami himself said, it makes you a little uncomfortable sometimes. But Master also added, he said, I never intrude unless I'm invited. This is also what we have to understand. I know some people imagine, oh, I take a guru, I get on a spiritual path, and then I'm a slave to this power force. No, 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 no. I always say, no such luck. You know, no way that anybody's going to take over for you. If you want to run your own show, you get to run your own show. It's just as simple as that. You want to stay identified with your ego? We want to stay? Oh, we get to keep doing that. We want to be infatuated with all these little toys? We get to keep doing that. But once we invite the divine to come in. Master once, when he, I think it was Swamiji, he responded to, rubbed his hands together, now I can take charge of your life. Now we can get to work. Because what we have to have is we have to have some powerfully attractive alternative. Because you see, the consciousness will go somewhere. That's what people find. They sit down to meditate and then they come ruefully, well, gee, I found my mind wandering a little bit, as if everyone else just closes their eyes and whoop, that's it. You know, the mind wanders a little bit, doesn't it? Maybe just a teeny bit. Maybe I'm just speaking for myself. But you know, these little things come floating along, and aren't they attractive? Some of them are not attractive, some of them are ugly, but whatever they are, there they are. And it can just be as simple as, gee, I wonder if I should have the cheese quiche or the spinach quiche, you know? Or gee, if those shoes were so nice, they would look so good with that dress. Or I wonder why he said that to me. He really shouldn't have said that to me. Whatever it is, you know, it just goes like this. The mind begins to grab it, and then pretty soon we're off on this long thing. Now, you can't just stop that. What you have to do is you have to bring into your reality something that's more attractive. That's what Gandhi said. He said, you can't discipline yourself out of your bad habits. You can't give up a habit at all, he said, until you have something that's more desirable. Don't even try until something else is more desirable. So really, the whole spiritual path is to find ways to bring into our consciousness an experience that's more attractive than the habitual identification with the ego. It's bliss that we're seeking, after all. Everything that the ego seeks out, it doesn't seek out because, oh, I think I'll torture myself with this today. In fact, we may be torturing ourselves with this today, but we don't think about it like that. Even when we're being tortured and know we're being tortured, it's still some part of us. I remember when I was counseling with this very wise woman, and I explained this terrible situation I was in with a fundamental attitude. And she said, and so, how is that working for you? And what are you getting from that? And I just stopped for a second, and I just turned it around. What am I getting from that? I could suddenly see all the things I was getting from that wrong attitude. It was protecting me from alternatives and various things like that. But of course you're getting something from it. When you're not getting something from it anymore, you put it down. Isn't that the truth? It's not an effort to put it down, as it's not serving you anymore. But the whole spiritual path, I started to say, is the process of giving yourself experiences of something so much more satisfying that you just aren't interested in this anymore. You know, when I became a vegetarian, somebody said, oh, you know, was that difficult? No, I just lost interest. When you give up smoking, you give up drinking, you give up other habits, you just lose interest because there's something else so much more attractive. And so the masters give us songs, they give us prayers, we give us worship service, we give us communities, but above all, they give us their consciousness. As many as received him, it says in the Bible, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. I only go where I'm invited. That's what the master said. You invite the divine light in, suddenly you're in the divine light. And that's really all that matters. I want to close with a little story about Swamiji. It was so moving to me. When we were in Lugano just a month ago, we were with Swamiji at this big restaurant where we went to have fondue in Switzerland. We were with a group of Swiss people and all of us. There must have been 20 at the table or more. Long, narrow table, noisy place. Swamiji's hearing is not that great. There were people talking in several different languages. It was just very chaotic. And he was energetic, but not that much, but he just couldn't compete. It wasn't a situation that worked for him. So he was just virtually silent through the entire night. And of course, especially when he was younger, or I would say, it wasn't just a matter of youth, it was a different phase of his life. Swami used to just command a table, command the room. It didn't matter how many people were there. He has this huge voice and this enormous presence, and he would just entertain and hold forth for the whole night. He was almost silent. And after we went back to the hotel and he was going up to his room, he said something about, I'm pretty dull company. And he commented that he couldn't hear that well and he didn't have anything to say. I said, Swamiji, but your presence define that entire room. There wasn't one of us in that room that wasn't constantly relating to you. And the whole atmosphere was profoundly uplifted just because he was there. It was particularly dramatic to me because there was this young man at this end of the table who'd never met Swamiji before. He was way beyond. He couldn't even see him from where he was sitting. But it was almost you could see his aura leaning into Swami's the whole night. I said, "Sir, we were all uplifted just because you were there, and Swami knows this." He got this wonderful look on his face, and he said, "That's all that matters." He said, "All the books, all the music, everything else I've done," he said, "none of it makes any difference. The only thing that really matters is to uplift consciousness." And he said, "That's what I pray to Master to be able to do, is to uplift consciousness." And I heard that very deeply, and then just when he was here, just something happened, and he answered a similar question in exactly the same way. "The only thing that matters, the only thing I pray for is to be able to uplift people's consciousness." Now, this is how it all came together for me, and I really want to share it with you. Think how simple that is. You see, that removes us from whether we like people or not. It removes people from our own personality. It removes us from everybody else's personality. It removes us from talent or lack of talent. It removes us from everything. And you see, also, as soon as we, or and we know this from our own experience, as soon as our consciousness is uplifted just a little even, the whole perspective changes, doesn't it? If we're angry about this or desirous about that, all those things that the Gita describes as the death of our spiritual life, as soon as our consciousness is uplifted just a little bit, that becomes the object of our desire, and all of this just fades away. The spiritual path ultimately becomes so simple. It's just like, am I contributing an uplifting influence to this situation, or am I not? And if I'm not, then we have to back up and look to our consciousness and find that point within us where we are looking upward to whatever little bit of light we can see. Even the lowest person, even us in our lowest state of consciousness, can always be uplifted a little. And then we can always turn to others and offer that same light. And once we begin to do that, you see, that's the invitation to the masters. What is it that I want? If I want toys, then I get toys. If I want upliftment, then the master says, "Now I can take charge of your life."